Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondra.
I'm Jim Seals.
And I am Aide Smith, not the Hulk, again.
Well, are you still angry, though?
Actually, today I'm pretty good, so...
You're definitely not the Hulk. Well, listen, so we are here to talk about Absolute Candor, the fourth episode of Star Trek Picard, which just came out a couple of days ago.
Also known as the best episode of Star Trek Picard.
Which is exactly what we're going to talk about. So we began the episode, as is now customary, with a flashback to the events surrounding the Romulan supernova and the android attack on Mars. Picard arrives on the planet Vashti, where some Romulans have been resettled, and in theory that's temporary, but we find out later that it's become permanent. We're introduced to the Koat Milot, an order of Romulan nuns who practice absolute candor, which is not just telling the truth at all times, but also like no filter between whatever you're thinking or feeling and whatever you say. And then there's a boy there whose name is Elnor, who the nuns are taking care of, again, in theory, temporarily. And he and Picard bond over adventure fiction, and specifically the Three Musketeers and the character of D'Artagnan. But when Mars is destroyed, Picard leaves. And he doesn't know it at the time, but he's basically abandoning them. Like, he'll never go back because he quits Starfleet and he abandons all that and just hides in his chateau for 14 years. So then now, 14 years later, he's going back. And we sort of derail the plot to go find our – what's his name?
Elnor.
No, the scientist we're going in search of.
Oh, Bruce Maddox.
Maddox. We abandon this. We temporarily swerve aside from Maddox to go back to Vashti, where Picard basically has to apologize to everybody for, in his own words, he says, for letting the perfect become the enemy of the good, which reminded me of some things that maybe we can talk about today. And then abandoning the Romulans after Starfleet pulls out. And he asks Elnor, who's now grown and is apparently like one of the greatest warriors of this whole cult of warrior nuns, asks Elnor to join him. But initially, Elnor says no. But then when Picard gets into a fight with a former Romulan senator, Elnor saves him and joins the team. And they beam up to the middle of a fight with an old Romulan warbird, where they save 7 of 9, who shows up in the last 10 seconds of the episode. And that's the recap. Yeah, a lot happened last episode. So where should we start? Let's just give a – what did you guys think? Jim, you have strong opinions on this episode?
I think it's the best episode that CBS All Access has done with this Kurtzman era of Trek.
And you like a lot of that Captain Pike stuff from Discovery Season 2.
Yeah, those are that's not to denigrate what has been accomplished on Discovery or Picard to this point. But I just felt like all the pieces
– yeah.
Like, we got an entire story, a picture of this one character's life, and we got the ramifications that this character has on Picard.
Yeah.
The previous episode I would have given that honor to was Lesky from Season 1 of Discovery, which is the episode where Sarek gets blown up in the shuttlecraft, and they have to recontextualize the Sarek Spock schism
with
Michael Burnham in it.
That's the episode where we find out that Sarek torpedoes Burnham's application to the Vulcan Science Academy so that he can save the spot for Spock.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spock ends up refusing to go and joining Starfleet instead. And so Sarek did a bad thing. He should not have held Burnham back. But then he's punished for doing the bad thing. Like fate screws him, right? And says, if you're going to do a bad thing, we're going to make it come out to nothing. Yeah. It's a great episode because it retcons. You use the phrase recontextualizing, but I'm still a comics guy, so I still think of it as retconning. I think it's a good retcon, but it's a retcon nonetheless, right?
I mean, it falls under all the parlances of what a retcon is. But I sort of feel like nothing is moved.
Yeah, exactly. There's two different retcons. One where it changes everything and one where it just fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
Like nothing fills in the gaps.
Like, it's not like establishing that Parasite is that Parallax is this alien space entity. Like, that's a giant movement in the Green Lantern mythos. That's not a slight, like, this is how we're going to look at it from this other lens.
So for those of you that are not Green Lantern and comics readers, but are listening to us because you wanted to talk Star Trek, this is also the Dark Phoenix plot, right? Where we had a hero that turns into a villain, but we don't want them to stay a villain because we want them to be a hero again. So we invent a new bad guy that is actually the villain, and the hero was just a victim in all of this. Aid, what did you think about the episode?
Yeah, it was good. It was... It was cool. I like, we've got some more stuff. The only thing I'm worried about at the moment is pacing.
Okay.
Because we are now just at the halfway through the season, and we haven't got to the first drop-off point yet. we're off to this gambling place. Oh yeah, I'm just going to stop off somewhere else for an episode. It's like, crikey. So I'm really concerned that they're going to jam the last part of the two episodes together, and like everything's gonna be rushed really quickly.
Yeah.
I'm hoping we don't get that. I'm hoping that even though this is season one, there's gonna be stuff that will leak over to season two, because the idea we've only got six episodes left to get everything resolved seems really, really, quick. You know, it's gonna be over quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. The episode itself though was really good. We got to see another hologram of the captain, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
We got to see some spaceshipy stuff. We got to see some even more diverse Romulans, which was good.
We actually got two different holograms of the captain in this episode, right?
Yeah.
Hospitality.
Oh, yeah, of course we did. Yes,
the hospitality guy who's like always inside Picard's personal space, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. But again, I think if nothing else, this is really filling a load of Romulan backstory in that Reva's previously like, they're the bad guys. We don't know anything about them because they're secret. There's a lot more to Romulan society than seems to be previously explored, which is really cool.
So,
Go on, sir. Go on. Carry on.
So we have to talk about the Romulan warrior nuns. Like,
yes. I mean,
And we're going to get to Elnor. And I know, Jim, you had strong feelings about Elnor. And we talked last week about how they created this character who's sort of perfect fit for you. So we'll get to them. But we had this whole like secret order of warrior nuns, the Koat Milat, and I'm wondering like what are your thoughts on them, or what do you think? Anybody?
I like the setup.
Okay.
I'm of two minds of it.
Yeah.
We establish that those are all of fighting women, and the main representative of that will be male.
That's right. That's true. Yes.
Moving forward from this point onward. Yeah. Like, I understand that they wanted to create sort of a wolf paradigm where they're raised within a culture that they don't necessarily belong to and will never belong to because of the randomness of their wolf.
Right.
And I get that that's where they're going, but it does sort of detract from the idea of, we create this awesome female empowerment message, but we're going to show it to you through the lens of a male.
Right.
Like, if I had to detract any sort of points, like, that would be sort of like globally thinking in terms of like, what is Star Trek supposed to be telling us? Though subconsciously telling us that, you know, the best representative of these fighting women is a man.
Right.
So
I get that.
It's sort of like, it gives us something, and it gives us something interesting, and I like to explore that more. And again, I do like Elnor's character because he has all the things I like. you know, he's got daddy issues built into him. He's got my love of Dumas.
Yes.
He's got many things that I like in my fictional characters, but I'm still trying to like struggle the macro with the micro, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I think the idea that he didn't have to be so great, because the idea they were saying about, okay, the actual society that we teach in is for the women. He picked up some skills as well, so we want to get rid of it, rather than kind of like, oh yeah, we taught him everything our women know, but he's not technically belonging to the society.
Right.
Because even like the idea that he had to take the actual the oath, which was their oath. So it's like, well, so he is then, isn't he? Come on. If he's taking the oath and he's got all the skills, he is, but you just don't want to call it. So I think it would have been nice if he was still kind of a slightly more of an outsider. So he's like, okay, he's a really kick-ass guy. He can do stuff, but he will never be part of society, so he has to go. and that would have been kind of like a bit more to it.
I kind of think like I like the whole way of absolute candle.
Yeah.
Is Veil, like the way of the Bushido. Like they've essentially created like yes, we call them warrior nuns in the show, but they've essentially created like a samurai warrior caste. You know, yeah. we do it obviously becoming someone's master or someone's prisoner is really important. And they've created essentially a Ronin character. Mm. And it feels like sort of like Chris Claremont's version of Wolverine at a certain point where he's like, I'm always trying to strive for this samurai, this ideal, this fighting ideal, and I'll never actualize it for myself. But because I'm doing all the tropes, everyone else around me is like, hey, dude, you're a samurai. Calm down. We get it.
I thought about this a little bit between watching the episode and today. And what struck me was all the ways that it could have gone really bad. And I think that making Elnor, making the representative of the warrior nuns, a young man raised by the nuns, is intentionally designed to address all the ways this could have gone really bad. Because like you two, like I remember like bad 90s comics, right? When we had like warrior nun Ariella and stuff like that. And like the idea of a warrior nun, Romulan warrior nuns, could have gone south so terribly wrong, right? They could have been like dressed like all the other sexy Romulans that we see in the show, right? And it could have been written for titillation.
Mm-hmm.
But by presenting them as this female order, setting them up as warrior nuns, but then not doing the titillation, by giving them a young male protagonist whom they have raised as their son, so that they're all like maternal figures to him, avoids all that, and it allows us to create this order, which is a feminist, women-only order, but avoids the trap of sexualizing them. That might have happened if we had gotten a female character that was actually doing all of that. Those of you that know me, I have like this test for movies and television shows that I call the Tondro test, which is, does it make me want to run a role-playing game?
Yeah.
And a lot of movies which are really bad pass the Tondro test. Like it's not a quality measure. Like the Star Wars prequels pass because I want to rewrite every goddamn scene in those movies, right? Like I want to run a game that rewrites them. So it passes the test, but for the wrong reason. But anyway, I loved this episode because I loved the Coat Milot. Because I guarantee you, over this coming week, hundreds, maybe thousands of people around the world will roll up Romulan warrior nun PC in Star Trek games, on Star Trek Online. I guarantee you. Like in the last 48 hours, hundreds of Romulan warrior nuns who can only tell the truth have been made.
That's the best point. That's the best point. The non-filtered, because yeah. Like up to this point, like let's get back to the yeah. I don't mean to derail.
No, that's okay.
But the idea is like this is the first time Picard is actually not equivocating.
Right.
Like, yeah, he acknowledges that he, like in the prior episodes, he's acknowledging that, yes, I have failed or I didn't accomplish the mission.
Yes.
But now he's acknowledging he's taking ownership of all of his culpability.
Yeah.
So his taking ownership of Elnor is once again him establishing, like, I messed up. And this show is so much about second chances. But right. The fact that they have this, they're going to have a character who is absolutely living. Like, we always said that Vulcans never lie, right? Like, that was a thing in the original series, but they lied.
Yeah, we know that's not true. Just like Klingons never take prisoners. These are the fallacies of Star Trek.
And now we have a Romulan who is the best representation of sort of what Vulcans will proposed in the original series, who can't actually tell a lie because his code dictates that.
Right, right. Yeah.
And if Elnor does not team up with a cat at some point in the show, that's a wasted opportunity.
Why a cat?
Either by a Catlan, like a Maurice-style animated series cat lady at some point, or actually becomes like an owner of a cat.
Okay, why does he need to have a cat? I don't get
because
it.
Because he tells Picard.
He
talks about Spot, and then he talks about, I've still never seen a cat.
Yes, okay, yeah. All right.
If he doesn't come across a cat in some way, shape, or form,
yeah,
missed opportunity.
I'm sure that'll get picked up.
Yeah.
So what I find fascinating about the organization is they mention they're strongly opposed to the Tal Shiar.
Yeah.
But the Tal Shiar seem to have let them exist on another planet somewhere. They haven't just gone, well, we'll just get rid of them. Because the Romulans are not known for their friendliness and their subtlety. So the idea they've kind of like, hey, there's an entire organization of warrior nuns that really, really hate us. Yeah, let them carry on.
I presume that that's just because they're such badasses. Like the
Well, maybe. Maybe they just defeat everyone that comes to them. But yeah, that was, because I assumed it was like it could be like a secret thing, but you know, like a secret enclave somewhere.
Like a cultural significance, because they do make a point, like to Aide's point, like the Romulans could just blow them up from space, right?
Right.
They actually say that your sword's not going to do anything against my blaster. Right?
Yeah.
You know, during the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And so I've got this brand new adventure.
Cultural safeguard protecting these nuns that's beyond, you know, normal standard Romulan operating procedure.
Yeah, and I think it was perfectly appropriate. Like, if you're thinking about, okay, like, let's create this sort of mystic, semi-mystic religious order among the Romulans. So what are the taboos that this group breaks? And the answer is that they don't do the one thing all Romulans do, which is lie all the time.
Mm.
Right? And I thought that was brilliant. So as far as a role-playing character, they're a perfect hook. They give you a bunch of badass abilities. They have a cool role-playing hook that you always tell the truth. And there are women, young and old, all around America today who are now planning their Romulan warrior monk cosplay outfit for the next Star Trek convention, right? And I just think that's wonderful. So I love that world building stuff. That's what I really, that was my favorite bit about this episode. All right, so let's talk about the kid. Let's talk about Elnor. There's been a lot of talk about who this character would be since we saw previews and trailers with the, some people were calling him Mirror Universe Legolas.
Well, he's a better Legolas than the Orlando Bloom Legolas. It's possible that his hair is actually the color of midnight.
Yes, right, yeah.
That's the only description we get from Legolas in the books.
He's a blonde. So for those who are not in on this long-running, ferocious Tolkien debate, which is right up there with Do Balrogs Have Wings, is what color is Legolas's hair? Because although Tolkien comes in for constant flack from readers that he spends too much time on detail, in point of fact, he almost never gives physical descriptions of people. And the only thing we know about Legolas' physical description is that at one point, it's actually when he's shooting the bow against the Nazgul who's flying through the air, that he's described as having hair that's like midnight. But of course, that scene is set at night. And so a lot of people who insist that Legolas is blonde say that's just because it's dark, right? I know. Yeah, he should.
Like, I don't buy that. I've never bought that.
Legolas should have black hair and gray eyes because every beautiful character in Tolkien has black hair and gray eyes. And that's because Tolkien's wife had black hair and gray eyes. And so that's his definition of what is most beautiful in the world. And elves have dark hair. That's what makes Galadriel unique. That's her name, refers to her golden hair in Elvish. Like that's her thing. But we digress.
well, to bring it back to the episode, what did you think of the design aesthetics of the planet, which are very evocative of sort of like middle imagery with the constant autumn look of the trees and the flying, the little butterflies and whatnot.
The physical look of the place, the thing that struck me was when you were talking about describing Elnor as a Ronin. Because, of course, his sword is a straight-up curved Japanese samurai sword.
Yeah.
I don't think it doesn't have a
guard, no.
Guard. Yeah. There's not a guard. But other than that, it's a straight up, it's a curved samurai sword, like a katana or a wakizashi. Abe, what'd you think?
I think he's a cool character. Now, unless I'm mistaken, he's obviously the brother of the other Romulan, isn't he?
Oh, you think he...
Did no one think that? Because that was the first piece of the show up. He's his brother.
Jim just nodded. You thought...
All right. He's got to be.
I'm still holding that fan theory.
He's got to be the guy's brother. There's no way in hell you introduce two cool Romulan characters that are not related.
Oh.
And my other plot point. I was watching the episode like just the last hour before we were calling the podcast.
Yeah.
And I found that I just tune out the moment Narek's on screen.
Yeah.
Like instantly don't have time for his bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what it is my concern is that we have another Kylo Ren situation where they're going to show a very toxic masculine romantic interest as a redemption story.
Yes.
Right. And I don't want that.
Yeah.
Like modern Trek, you know, Kurtzman era Trek has had difficulties exploring problematic relationships and handling them with tact. I'm looking at Ash Tyler in specific. And I don't think we need another representation of a codependent, male-dominant relationship, domineering relationship, where he is manipulating his female partner, and then having it be like he falls in love with her and then is saved by the actions of some one good thing he does.
Go back and tell me what other character you're talking about that I didn't recognize.
What was that?
The other character you mentioned that did this, you said you were...
Ash Tyler from Discovery.
The Klingon...
Yeah, that was terrible. Yeah, okay, yeah. So for those of you that have not seen Discovery, like Ash is this human guy, and he gets in sort of this sadomasochistic relationship with this Klingon woman who tortures him, but he loves her. Because of the torture, and it's
well. Then, in addition, he winds up becoming like he's an abuser to Michael Bonham. He's then forgiven in another next episode. He's then a rape survival. He's then like he's just a muddled mess of we can't figure out what metaphor we want to use, so we're going to use all the metaphors.
He murdered the doctor,
and then he murders Kobol.
Yeah. But he gets let off. He gets forgiven. Yeah.
That's a whole nother. We're not doing the Star Trek Discovery podcast. I'm just pointing out the fact that I don't want another of these stories where we have a toxic romantic relationship that the male figure is ultimately redeemed by the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. I got no problem with him manipulating the android. I can't remember what her name is again. Purely because he's supposed to be an ass. That is his point. He's supposed to be a complete idiot and he's supposed to be the bad guy. The idea that he can go, oh, thanks. Oh, are you responsible for the deaths of several thousand people? Whatever. Oh, yeah, here you go. Here's your getaway card because you fell in love with me. That's not good enough.
I kind of want the end of that plot line to be him, like her saying, I thought you loved me. And he's like, I lied my ass off to you. Draws his gun. Like, I want it to be that, right? Yeah.
It's, you know, it even. I don't know. Yeah, but it's a very. I mean, it's kind of similar to. I think it's the whole Twilight trope thing, isn't it? Where he may be a vampire, but at his heart, he's a good guy. So yeah. Okay.
The outcome I see coming is exactly what you're afraid of, which is he defends Soji against his sister who killed him, and he dies redeemed in death.
Yeah, right? I don't want that. Like we have too many representations of this sort of toxic and romantic relationships in all fiction currently. And I don't want Star Trek to continue perpetuating it.
That's fair. That's fair. It would be nice if we got a positive romantic relationship in the show, which we don't really see.
Well, we do have the romantic relationship between the Doctor and the Engineer on Discovery. They have their issues, but once they walk through them, they'll support it.
They're probably the most stable couple out of everybody, aren't they? Which is pretty cool. So yeah.
We have assembled all the crew together, however. So we do have a half a dozen pretty attractive, interesting people on a starship for the next five episodes. So who knows what could happen, right?
True. But again, we've only got five episodes left. We don't need a romantic subplot as well. Come on, we want to get with the robots. We want to get what's going on with the droids.
So Jim, tell us about Elnor. Like, tell us what you like about this. What you think about this character?
Getting back to the point of it's sort of on paper, it's what we are told Vulcans always were. Like when you have like a list of things, you're like Vulcans. They're stoic. This character has a sort of stoicism when he's around Picard. He like it's even commented by Zanny, the main head of the Ono, that he has a reticence when Admiral Picon's around.
Right, right.
You know, that aspect of it. But he's still not above showing emotion, like when he throws the food down, when he's rejected.
Yeah.
Or when he gets angry and storms out of the room. And then you have this other aspect of he absolutely has to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Like in a show sort of built on lies and like Federation secrets and Starfleet being sketchy, like the most honest person in the show, he's not lying to anyone. When he's a kid, he's like, you know, you hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
Like, what's the most bravest thing you can do as a child is to tell your father figure, you hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
He loves that in like the first few minutes that we all spend time with them.
Yeah.
And I feel like the log line for the whole episode is Picard holds his feelings.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I love the cold open because we don't understand what's going on at first. We just mm-hmm. know everyone is saying exactly what they think. And we're like, why are you doing this? And then we figure out that's their code.
Yeah.
And it starts to make sense. But that, yeah, I it was a great opening.
Yeah, and like the way Picard handles him when he's an adult is he approaches it from a diplomatic situation.
Yeah,
right. Like he wants to vote. He wants there to be rituals. Like I think Picard would feel like in that moment where he's like, you know, my knees are pretty bad. Like if Elnor put him on his knees, I think he'd sort of feel a little bit better about it because what does Picard like to do? He likes a mind ritual. He likes to sort of like. Get wrapped up in pomp and circumstance. He's always done that.
He's an anthropologist. He loves culture.
Yeah, and Elnor's like, no, you just tell me a story. You tell me a sad story. Yeah. Like, and he continues handling it like as a diplomatic situation. He doesn't handle it like a father reconnecting with his son.
You're right. It's very much a negotiation. I remember when he says, like, okay, well, I've told you my story, so does it qualify? I think my story qualifies. Like, he's giving the pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's that moment. There's a moment in the whole speech where Arnold sort of blinks and goes, you know, did you miss me?
Yeah.
And even though Picard answers it directly and honestly, he doesn't put any emotional intelligence behind it. Like, I just get this image of Deanna shaking her head. Like, you know, we did this. Like, you know. Misty's struggling with we did this, you know, we've shown Picard sort of become emotionally intelligent. This really smart man who gains emotions by the end of the show. It's sort of like his arc through TNG if you want to like look at it macroly, in a macro sense. But here it's like he totally misses the ball, and that's why Elnor says no. Like that's why he initially says no, you had your moment to not sell me in the mission. Like, why is it that you want me? Like, he even says, like, why me?
Why me? Yeah, you need somebody, but why me? Yeah.
Yeah, he's basically begging him to be like, acknowledge me as a person, not me as an instrument.
Right. You're absolutely right. And Picard does not do that. And I was surprised how the episode ended. Not that they got together because we saw that coming, but the way that it, like, I don't know if Elnor's decision to protect Picard really goes any further than I don't want you to die, so I guess I have to help you.
I think he's looking for that. He's looking for the Wesley thing. Like he's looking for the Wesley moment of false duty to be like, you know, I'm proud of you.
Yeah,
that's sort of what he wants.
You're right. You're right. He wants the admiration of the father for the son.
Yeah.
So I have to talk about Elnor for a minute because I love the scene. I was watching the show. And when Elnor has his like make my day moment that he talks to the Romulan senator, and this is like I'm kind of obsessed with these make my day lines, which is the moment when a hero is about to fight somebody and tries to urge them not to fight, right? And how they do it is a real writing challenge because it has to reflect the character of the hero. So when Dirty Harry pulls out the giant gun and says, "Go ahead, punk, make my day." It's not just telling the guy, don't fight me. It's actually saying, I want you to fight me. I'm really kind of eager for it. And I'd be really a lot happier in my fucked up, miserable existence if I get to shoot you, right? Like right. It's really kind of awful. And then there's a bunch of other kind of great examples of this. And like I said, I'm going off for a minute, but please just bear with me. I will get back to the show. And the classic version for me is this moment in the old Western Silverado when Danny Glover's character, Mal, has a rifle pointed at some guy's head and he says, "I don't want to kill you and you don't want to be dead," right? Which is perfectly Mal. Like, it shows, I don't want to kill you. I am a reluctant killer. However, I also understand you. I can put myself in your position. You don't want to be dead. I'm displaying empathy, right? Like, then you had that wonderful Princess Bride conversation with, like, Inigo Montoya and the Man in Black, right? Inigo's like, "You seem a decent fellow. I hate to kill you." And Wesley says, "You seem a decent fellow. I hate to die." Right? And it's just hilarious. And it's got, you know, this wonderful, like, sense of character for them both. And we understand what they both are like. And then we get Elnor's choose to live line, which is wonderful because we have spent the last 45 minutes setting up that Elnor always tells the truth and exactly what he's thinking, right? So he is not shitting anybody when he says, "You can choose to live or you can choose to die. And those are the only two outcomes that are going to happen in this instant," right? And then, like, the Romulan just, like, turns away. And then there's this, like, weird sort of blurry thing that he does, and the dude's head falls off. And I'm like, holy shit. I loved it. I thought it was great. And, like, the green seam appears on the guy's neck, and everyone just looks as this head slides off. And I know we've talked about a lot of things in this show that make it obvious it's a streaming show and not prime time, like swearing and sex. But let me tell you, like, the fact that you have never been able to see someone get their head chopped off in Star Trek until now, I thought was great. I love that whole bit. I thought it was wonderfully written. I thought Chabon is a genius. And anyway, all right, I'm done.
It's a great line. Like, yeah. I have nothing to add to that. Like, it's a great line. It's a great moment. I like the follow up moment. Like, for me, what makes it so great is he says this thing.
Yeah.
And then when Picard's alone with them, like, Grant and Raffi and Dr. Girardi are in the room, but when they're in the transporter room, he says, like, "You can come with us, but when I, you know, I'm going to tell you when to fight, but I'm also going to tell you when to fight."
It's a classic Terminator 2 moment, right?
Yes, it is.
You know, you can't kill anyone. It's like, they'll live, right? I swear I won't kill anyone. Like, it's that moment. But I loved it because Picard does get angry. Like, he's really angry with Elnor. He's like, "That guy didn't need to die. You didn't need to kill him." And Elnor's like, "I told him I was going to kill him. Like, I don't get it. Like, I told him I was going to kill him, and then he asked me to kill him." Like, anyway. So, yeah, I thought that Picard was really honest in that moment, which was good. I think Elnor's going to be good for Picard because Elnor's going to keep Picard honest.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So of that, talking about that scene, I have some questions for you guys. I need to know something. Okay, so Picard walks away. He's been rejected by Elnor, and he calls to the ship, and Rios is like, "Okay, we got 7 minutes before I can pick you up." And Picard, like, goes up to the Romulan-only bar, and he takes the Romulan-only sign off, drops it in the dirt, steps on it, walks into the Romulan bar where he knows nobody's going to listen to him, sits down at a table, and I mean, is he picking a fight? Does Picard go in there and make the Romulans attack him because he knows Elnor will rescue him and therefore join the team? Or was he sincerely trying to break down bigotry and racism and break through to these Romulans? Abe?
I'd say the first one originally, except it's Picard. So Picard, anybody else would say it's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, but
because Picard, it seemed wrong. Yeah. So, I mean, I did wonder that. I thought, okay, so it's like, all right, is he either going to, like, do something and then get beamed out because he knows in 7 minutes what I'm off?
Yeah.
Or you know, but it just seems like, just leave it alone, man. Okay, they're isolated from everybody else. Yes, you don't like what they're doing, but crikey, you're going to get yourself in some bad situation if you start screwing with them. So just leave them alone. It's all done. So I don't know. I don't know if he's in. I can't believe he's trying to inspire the samurai chap to come and help him because obviously he's been rejected. So the idea, but it just seems. Yeah, I can't believe he's doing it on purpose either. So I don't know,
Jim.
I'm on the other side of the fence.
Okay.
I think the sign is anathema to everything Picard believes in.
Yeah, I think that he just couldn't restrain himself. He had to do something.
Yeah, because if Vashti becomes the metaphorical, like he even says that this was his home after a fashion.
Yeah.
Like right before they come to the planet, he acknowledges how much this place meant to him.
Yeah.
When doing the return trek. And I think the fact that we saw, as an audience, we saw Romulans cooperating, and we saw them working together, and we saw them with no weapons in their hands in the first 14, you know, the flashback, in the first part of the episode, to the point where everyone has weapons, and you have these Romulan false sort of like Nazi symbols on their armbands. Like, that's intentional iconography right there.
Yeah.
And he's just like, and he comments on the racial bigotry and the racial strife and the poverty. And it's sort of like, if this is his greatest sin, because he allowed the good to be the enemy, the perfect to be the enemy of the good.
Yeah.
He's gonna do his best to fix it. Like, is it gonna be constructive? No, I just think he's in that moment, he's being genuine. Like, this is what he believes in. He believes that people should work together.
I'd agree with you.
Yeah.
Except for the fact the planet doesn't seem very multicultural. There doesn't seem to be Klingons or humans wandering around. You got the impression this was like a Romulan split thing. So the idea you've got a Romulan-only bar on a largely Romulan-held world just seems a bit weird. I think if there was more other people and you saw them kind of getting maybe jostled in the street and that, but the idea you've saved Romulans and brought them to here, and then they've kind of got, oh, we've got our own little bar, but you know, there's no humans around, so it just seems a bit weird. I would have liked to have seen other people as well. Some humans, some Klingons, just to kind of drive that point home.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It does make perfect sense, but it just seemed to be like, well, you know, the odd what's it called? Oh my god, I've completely gone blank of Star Trek races now. Mugato or whatever running around, you know, classic Star Trek races, all those Orions or something, anything like that. I mean, Orions would be perfect. If they say it's devolved into some kind of pirate land, the idea that there's Orions running around and this is Romulans only. But it's not. The other thing is, if this is something that the Romulans traveled to 14 years ago, technically speaking, the Romulans are the domineering race. They're not kind of like, ever been kind of like, oh, well, you've only got this bar because we've allowed you to have it. So they're kind of showing their power, but they don't seem to be showing their power to anybody in particular. There doesn't seem to be anybody that they're kind of annoying to be doing so. No. So,
I think this is a failing of the episode's direction, which I'm going to give Jonathan Frakes due in a second. Yeah. It's an example of telling, not showing, because when they explain where all the other systems are on the planet, they do say that they're protecting human Romulan Terrans and Romulans alike in like riverbeds and villages. So you get the idea that they're scattered throughout this planet doing you know, the good work of their order, but we should have seen something else.
Yeah, because they shunned the card.
If we just saw, you know, a background trail or Bajoran get, you know, beaten up in a, you know, in an alleyway somewhere, I think it would have solved that point.
Yeah, because when Picard shows up, you don't know if they're shunning Picard purely Picard because he's Picard or because he's human.
Right.
So yeah, I think the idea that it's like, yeah, you see some other of the several gazillion races we've got running around Star Trek there having a bit of a hard time would definitely help. Just as background noise, and that would make more sense of it.
There's a moment on the ship when they're trying to persuade Picard to not go to this planet, where we are reminded that this is Picard's farewell tour. We've seen this before with the doctor, when he talks to his old doctor back on Earth, and he gets his medical prognosis, and it's not good. And here, in this case, it's Raffi saying, look, we don't have to go here. Like, let's not pick a fight that we don't have to pick. And he says, look, I may not be this way again, which is a way for him to say, I'm near the end of this character's existence, right? And I think that maybe that explains partly of what he does at the Romulan bar, because I feel like Picard is now at the stage where he is leaving everything on the table. Like, if he walked by this Romulan bar and didn't say anything and didn't do anything, he would be haunted by that failure for the rest of his life, which is not very long, right? And so he's thinking, look, I need to start fixing things instead of walking by them and letting them get fixed by somebody else, right? Which is kind of what he does with the Romulans, right? Like when he quits Starfleet and goes and hides in his chateau. And he's like, I can't do that anymore. I have to be involved. And yes, I'm 80 years old and I can't do things as effectively as I used to be. My knees are not what they used to be, right? But I have to try. And maybe the fact that he knows he's going to get beamed out in 7 minutes might be why he does this. Because he's like, look, I got to try something. And if worse comes to worse, you know, Rios will beam me out probably before I die. Right?
Yeah, and I can't remember, obviously, the episode where we discover he's been stabbed through the back and got the mechanical heart. I can't remember why he's standing up, who he's standing up for in that instance as well. But obviously, he's done it before. Yeah.
What episode is it?
It's established in the episode Samaritan Snail, but we see it in the episode Tapestry.
Thank you.
He stands up for his buddy because his buddy's getting gypped in a pool game, yeah. And he gets stabbed in the hall.
Yeah.
And then laughs.
But what was the name of the alien that does that? I forgot.
Nausicaans.
The Nausicaan, yeah.
Gnoskans, there you go. Thank you. Yeah. 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 So it's not as though we have not seen it before.
So we touched on Soji and the whole Borg cube plot a little bit. Aid, what'd you think?
Don't know where it's going. Seems to be like, okay, yeah, we've got some, there's a Romulan thing. She's a destroyer. She seems to know she's a destroyer now, but we don't quite know where it's coming from.
One of the lines that they give suggests that she's going to somehow control or lead or command some kind of army of androids.
Yeah.
That's going to rise up and destroy everything.
Which, again, funny enough, was the almost the plot of season 2 of Discovery with the Section 31 machine thing taking over it. And it's like, hey, it's going to take control of all the AIs. It's going to kill things. Yeah. So that's interesting. But again, that makes sense. And you can kind of see. It's just trying to figure out who's doing what for what reason. Because it's technically speaking, you could say if it's true that she is the destroyer, technically our bad guy Romulans are actually the good guys because they're trying to save the universe.
And Narek, apparently, he tells her, there's no record of you being on this transport ship. And she's like, why don't you believe me? Like, she just says, screw you then. But of course, we've established that she has an insatiable curiosity. So next episode, she's going to go research that flight and she's going to find out she wasn't on it. And then she's going to begin investigating her own past. And that appears to be Narek's play. Rather than Narek finding out where all the androids are, he's going to get Soji to find out where all the androids are.
Mm.
I guess that's the plot. And then we have the whole thing with his sister and the whole, like, you know, sister flirting with her brother thing, which, you know, Game of Thrones in space, right?
We are getting Game of Thrones, yeah. And she's definitely gone on full-on Dark Phoenix with the costume change and everything. She's like, totally. It's like, hey, can I be sexy Romulan lady? Yes, I can.
Yeah. Jim, what do you think?
I just got to be honest. I'm just not feeling the bold plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, it's for me, it's the least interesting thing on the show.
Yeah.
I care about it because Picard cares about it.
Right.
But Picard doesn't even know about this. Like, all Picard
is
the android Doddle. He has no concept that he's going to face his greatest nemesis in some way, shape, or form.
I was into this, like, last episode when we saw, like, the Romulan tarot cards and stuff. Because if there's one way to secretly hook Tondro for your show, is to put culturally unique tarot cards in your world. But I'm also in it for Soji. I think the actress is really great. I think the character is interesting. I was sad when I thought that she died in the first episode, right?
She's pretty good because you get to, I mean, you know, no offense to young actors and actresses, you can get, you know, Some of them can be, oh my god, they're so white, you know, just grind on you gear every time. They're all good. I mean, there's nobody here that's, I mean, you know, everyone used to say the same with Wesley Crusher back in the day. Oh my god, Wesley, so annoying. I like Wesley Crusher. Wesley Crusher was fine with me, but he got better as he got older, obviously, because right. You know. So, but I think they did a really good job of her. But I don't think they made her. She's supposed to be super intelligent, but there's a reason for it. She's not like the best at everything because just for the sake of being the best at everything. She's an android, so that makes a damn good reason. She's Data's daughter, technically. I mean, she's got to be pretty damn good at some stuff. So
I did notice that in the trailer, in the "What Has Gone Before" section of this episode, that comes at the very beginning, they did replay the clip where Soji says, "I'm working with Hugh."
Yeah.
Remember last week we were talking about whether or not they ever actually used Hugh's
name. Oh, yeah, cool.
And they did. So they clarified that Hugh is going by the name Hugh now.
Hmm.
Or still.
Interesting.
And then, like, at the end of the episode, there's 7 of 9.
Yeah.
Before we get there.
Go.
Rewind a couple more minutes.
Okay, good.
So this is the first time we actually get to see a Border Prey in action. A classic TOS era Border Prey.
You mean since Balance of Terror?
Well, Balance of Terror, even then, we don't really see it move much. Right? Like, yeah. They have no cloaking. Like, Balance of Terror is a submarine movie, so we don't get to see its maneuverability. We don't get to see, like, since Balance of Terror, the original model for the Romulan ship was created by a man named Hua Chang, I believe.
Okay.
And he wasn't unionized.
Okay.
So they bought this prop from him, and Desilu Studios found out about it, and like, you can't pay this guy. So they gave him back the Romulan warboard, and he broke it, which is the common sort of lore about the ship. That's why when you see it again in the Deadly Yells in season 2, it's stock footage from Balance of Terror, and you never see it again. That's sort of the reason why the Enterprise, they use the Klingon ships.
Yeah.
And also, in addition, the Border Prey that we know as the Klingon Border Prey,
yes,
from Star Trek 3, was supposed to be a Romulan ship.
Yes.
That movie was written for Romulans, and it was only at the last minute changed to Klingons.
Right, right.
To give Kulk his, you know, great nemesis, I guess. Yeah. So it's like, finally we get to see this moment of the Romulan Border Prey, which has sort of filled up our imagination, sort of a headspace of what awesome things they can do. We actually get to see it in action. And for me, as a long-term fan, that was just that, like, I was giggling at a certain point just because I'm like, we've never seen this.
All right. So you were,
this is new stuff.
Bird of Prey.
Yeah, and the good thing about it is, like we mentioned on the very first episode, someone hasn't gone in there and said, Roman Bird of Prey, yeah, I like the design, but screw that. I'm going to design something better. So they've kept it instantly recognizable as that ship.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as you see it, you know exactly what it is. They haven't messed with it. Yeah, you know, textures, it might be different. It might not, you know, but it's instantly recognizable as that ship. We've got new ships out there, but we also have the classics.
It's all about the paint job. That ship is all about the paint job.
Yeah.
Like, it's got that eagle sort of falcon look on the bottom.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the design of the ship is actually very, very simple. It looks like something somebody made, you know, in like a couple of hours in the 1960s with no money. Right, like,
because it is something that someone made in a couple of hours with no money.
Yeah, exactly. That was my point. So, so yes, it was great to see the Romulan Bird of Prey and Starfleet.
And they use the sound effects. They use the sound effects in sort of like the classic. Like, I love how new CBS Star Trek is like, okay, we know you guys have watched the show so much. You've watched the various iterations that we're just going to start using the old sound effects.
That's great.
And that's going to be all emotional tattle. So even though, like Aid said, the textures are different and it's up-res for HD TVs, because you can't have a smooth ship. Like, you can't have something that's textureless because the audience will reject that. We've had 50 years of what spaceships actually look like and those panels. So you have to do that. But then the way they get around that is they're like, okay, here's all the classic sound effects that you need to sort of sell you on the idea that this is one continuous narrative as opposed to, you know, disparate eons.
Were those the disintegrator, the disruptor sounds from the... Well, I'm an old player of Starfleet Battles, which was an old Star Trek war game.
Yeah.
And now a bunch of old Starfleet Battles grognards are going nuts because they get to write up a new version of the Romulan Warbird, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that fight ends with beaming aboard Seven of Nine onto the ship. We knew Seven of Nine was coming. They've highlighted her in trailers and teasers. And we knew she was coming in this episode because she has a guest star credit at the beginning. So I knew, when I saw that, I was like, okay, so Seven of Nine shows up. And I'm like, when is she showing up? Because it's okay. the whole episode, like getting to the end, and where is she? So we should have known that in good old Marvel Comics fashion, she would appear on the last page, right?
So in the UK, because we got an Amazon Prime, we have the skip intro section, the skip recap. I didn't know she was coming. So when she arrived, you're like, oh my God, it's 7 of 9. So that was really cool. I had no idea she was in it at all.
Good. That's good. Okay. Right on. Good.
And for me, I missed the credit. Like I use the I use the intro to be like, okay, do I need to make any notes? Like where am I so far?
Yeah.
And for me, the clue was when they kept saying he, I'm like, that's not a he. That's gotta be she. That's gotta be Seven. And the entire time they're like really stressing, like he's in trouble and his life support's going on. I'm like, no.
What a great
like six times. I'm going with a she. Like even before she beams up, I'm like, that's a she.
So
like, as my jaded writing self, I'm like, okay, when you hit the pronoun game, I know the pronoun game.
And she is physically looking different than she used to look. She's much more human now in her demeanor and appearance.
She's a little held down.
She let her hair down, literally.
Yeah, literally.
What are we looking for from Seven of Nine in next episode?
There's got to be, I mean, two angles, isn't it? Two angles is that she's followed Picard out there because she knows he's up to something, or she knows about the Borg block and she's tried to find him. That's literally the only two angles I can think of. You cannot have an ex-Borg character that does not know about what Hugh's doing on the cube. It just seems such a weird character to pick.
But you do. Locutus doesn't know anything about what's going on with Hugh's plot.
Yeah, true. All right.
Yeah. So it could be that it's so like they could be trying to inject a feeling of vastness in Star Trek that we haven't really gotten since like the first two seasons.
Maybe. Yeah. I just think she's just again, you, like we said last time, we don't know if this is a situation where you ask around all the people that want to put an appearance in, she's the first one accepted, they put her in, they're going to put her in there. Or it's like, yeah, she's integral because she's ex-Borg, so we need to get her in this show, otherwise we won't bother. It's another one of them weird things. But it could be in Worf. I mean, there's no reason it couldn't have been Worf if she's not involved in the plot somewhere along the line.
And the fact that, I mean, it's when they lay out the plot, it's okay, we got to get Seven. We've got to get all of the recovered Borg characters because that's our plot. Our plot is about recovered Borg, right?
Yeah.
We haven't gotten all of them because, remember, there was like a family of five Borg kids on Voyager.
Yes.
So we haven't gotten all of them.
You're right, yes.
They've gotten the marquee names. I think like when the showrunner sat down, they're like, okay, what are the episodes that everyone like is going to have seen of Next Generation? And it's like Best of Both Worlds. Like that's like top tier. Like that and the last episodes, like those are the big ones that everyone at some point would have graced upon. And like next tier, well, you're probably gonna hit into Eyeball. You know, you're gonna hit into that Hugh Borg episode because it is tied into Locutus. It is tied into John Luke's sort of rediscovery of humanity post assimilation. I think it's very sort of structured and like in terms of like what do people know about Star Trek for people who don't know Star Trek.
So were the
Borg kids that as a bad thing.
Were the Borg kids on Voyager when they actually came back to Earth?
I think so.
So if they were, then there's a very good chance that might why 7 of 9 might have involved herself in their rehabilitation. Therefore, it links to Hugh's chance to try and rehabilitate these Romulans as well. So that would kind of at least give it some kind of reasoning why she's there. Or you know, type back. I mean, yeah, it's like they might just forget him completely. But I mean, at least that would be some reason why she's about.
I know that she's part of that Fenris sort of security force through interviews that I read of her.
Oh, that's the Fenris Rangers.
The Fenris Ranger.
Oh, okay.
So she's why is she sort of assisting in this Romulan plot? I don't know what 7-9 role in the universe is.
Jim, you're breaking up. We just lost you out there for a second.
Yeah, he's.
I'm gonna ask if you can hear. I want you to disconnect and log back in. Yeah.
Crazy.
Go ahead, Abe.
Yeah, so I didn't realize if she's part of Ferris, that gives her another reason to be released around the planet, because obviously that's the system that she's in. But I'm very surprised if they, you know, she's got to be a reason to be there. Yeah. There's no reason, you don't get Jerry Ryan, ex-Borg character, not to be in a Borg serial. You just go, yeah, we're not going to use her. We're not going to use that plot of her.
I, of course, was not in the room when the series was brainstormed, so I don't know. But my impression was not that they were trying to hit all of the best Star Trek episodes, but rather that they looked at Picard and looked at his, what are his main plots? Like, what are Picard's plots? And Picard and Data were always the big money makers, the big audience grab characters for Next Generation. And his big enemies were the Romulans and the Borg. And so rather than trying to assemble a show and a cast and a set of story beats out of the episodes that we think everyone has seen, I think it was character driven based on Data and Picard. And where do we need, what story do we need to write that's most about them? The idea that this show is designed to bring new people to Star Trek, I actually disagree with that. I think that's Discovery. Discovery is the one that's got a bunch of new people that no one has ever heard of. I mean, at least for the first season, until Pike and all those deep dives show up. But I think that, and Mandalorian is a good example of a show that's designed to bring in new fans by bringing in, you know, Baby Yoda and stuff like that. But this show is, I think this show is designed and written not for people who never watched Star Trek or who have only seen a few episodes, but for people who are our age, who grew up with Next Generation. That was their Star Trek show, and they watched it religiously, and they're back for nostalgia.
Yeah. So this is why I like the show, right? Okay. I checked in my encyclopedia to see what episode, season, Measure of the Man was. Okay. And we're going back to 1988, okay?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, season two, exactly. 1988. Right. So again, slight tangent, right? But new Doctor Who, right? Doctor Who likes to do stuff where they go, okay, right, let's do lots of stuff about it, but we won't touch on anything before 2005 because people won't know about it. Let's not bother. So they would reinvent stuff that was very similar to this. This is something going on to 88, and they're referencing it because they're expecting people to know this stuff.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, okay, we might have some bad guys show up, but they're not going to go, oh, do you remember the... Right, okay, well, if you see this episode of The 13th Doctor, you must have seen the Third Doctor episode in 74 when it came out, because they don't touch it. And I like what they've done with this. I like the idea that they've managed to, again, like Jim was saying about the consistent universe.
Yeah.
It feels like an extension of the original universe rather than just a kind of boxed off bit where nothing really relates to anything else in the past.
They could have invented, they could have had any starship show up, but they picked a Bird of Prey.
Yeah. And it's not as though I don't like New Who, because I do like Doctor Who. I mean, I like Doctor Who old stuff. I like the new stuff as well. But they are really reluctant to cut. I mean, they kill the Time Lords off in the first series so they can get fixed effectively start from day one without having to reference them ever again. And so this show kind of referencing something from 88, this show, you know, Voyager episode, is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Jim?
Let me amend a couple things.
Sure.
I think something's being lost in translation. Maybe it got lost in the breakup of,
sure,
of the conversation line. When I say looking at episode, like this episode, like this series is obviously constructed. Like people think they're writing it, they're planning it. There was a storyboard meeting.
Yeah.
But they're not looking at episodes like When the Bow Breaks, right?
You don't know
what that episode is.
Right? Our listeners who have no idea what you're talking about, what that episode is, because now
so When the Bow Breaks is an episode where Wesley Crusher's kidnapped with a whole bunch of young prodigy children, and they're taken onto a alien space station, and they're told you can't get access to your kids. And Picard has to, in the full season, has to wrestle with his dislike of children and getting the kids back.
And like, they bring up the dislike of children in this episode at the very beginning, right? Yeah.
And they're not looking, like, I think what they're doing is they're looking at the totality of Star Trek, and they're being like, okay, this is, maybe it's not for the new fans necessarily, but it's definitely for the lapsed fan.
Okay.
And they're looking at, like, okay, everyone's seen these episodes, and these are the episodes that we're going to build around.
That's interesting. The idea that it's designed to recover the lapsed fan.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well,
the casual fan, because remember, Next Generation was so huge when it was out. Like, when Next Generation was in its stride, like, before, you know, like, right when Deep Space Nine was starting out, like, right when we heard rumors of another TV show.
Third season forward.
Yeah, third season up until, like, season seven. Like, season seven, it starts getting a little time. But, like, those prime years, like, Star Trek was in the zeitgeist. Star Trek was the zeitgeist.
Totally was.
People were showing up to jury duty in Trek uniforms.
Yeah.
Because they're like, I support the ideals of the Federation. Like, that's how big of a cultural impact it was. I think Picard is trying to get those fans back while still serving a purpose to the general public, in the sense of, this is a story that of second chances that needs to be told.
Well, and also, so speaking about the idea that it's saying something about our present situation, mm-hmm. I want to circle back to something we mentioned a lot earlier, which is that line by Picard, I let the perfect become the enemy of the good. That is a famous Obama quote. I know it's a cliche, but Obama used to talk about that all the time in private conversations with his staff, and it circulated out from that. It's kind of bubbled out from there because people were like, well, they were talking about healthcare. Like, it came out from the healthcare debate. Like, well, why don't we go for broke and do a big deal? And we can't do that, so let's can't get a public option. We can't get free healthcare, so let's just shelve the whole thing. And he was like, no, like, we have to do what we can. We have to not let the perfect become the enemy of the good. And this came up again in our elections. And I think that maybe this show is trying to address something about our expectations and our something about Americans where we say, well, I don't get the perfect thing that I want, so I'm not going to participate.
You say Next Generation also seems to be the key series where everybody likes, whereas sometimes you get to, like, oh, DS9, Voyager. Well, I didn't see much of Voyager. I didn't see much of DS9. But Next Generation is the one. So it's very few will come and someone say, I love Voyager. Never seen Next Generation of Deep Space Nine. Yeah. I don't think I've ever met anybody that likes Star Trek has ever said that to me. So
You want to talk about Frakes a little bit.
Well, to get back to your quote really quick.
Oh, sure.
It is telling that Picard is echoing Obama there. Like, the first time I met that quote was in Richard Wolff's Renegade book that came out with the 2008 election, sort of like encapsulation. Okay. And that was sort of like Obama's mission statement, like during the campaign.
Yeah.
And it's a quote that I try to live by working in academia in terms of, we talk these grandiose plans, and too often we get to the point where the grandiose is just too big. And then we wind up leaving behind some of our students.
Yeah, right.
So totally. Constantly something I'm dealing with. And the fact that Picard has failed that very blatantly, and he acknowledges it in this episode, and he owns it.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know what? If I have to get beaten up in a Romulan ball, I'll get my ass kicked in a Romulan ball to make this point.
To make this point, yeah. It's a good lesson.
Jonathan Frakes, in terms of, like, the direction, I feel that.
So for those that aren't aware, Frakes, who played Riker on Next Generation, was the director for this episode. Mm-hmm. And Frakes has got a long history of directing now. He's really quite he's got a very impressive list of credits. And he started back with episodes of Next Generation, and he did First Contact, I remember.
And Insurrection. Yeah.
But he's done a lot of other. He's a regular director now. He gets called in for a lot of episodic television.
Yeah, well, for me, it's just those just whenever Frakes is directing one of these CBS All Access shows, it just feels like there's a command of camera in terms of, like, the camera's steady. Like, it does, when it moves, it's moving with intention, and it's not moving for the sake of movement.
Okay.
Like, those that Super 8 does that sequence when all the kids are sitting around in exposition and they're in a circle and the camera's just constantly moving.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like Discovery is constantly moving the camera.
It is, yes, totally.
Except for when Frakes is directing, and then he just slows it down.
Lots of Dutch angles and stuff in Discovery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I you know, I'm not trying to take away anything from the previous director who did the last three episodes. I thought she did a great job. It just, it feels like those, without it being retro, it just feels like there was this calming presence behind the camera.
Well, I mean, it needs, the direction becomes invisible, right? Where mm-hmm. you don't notice it. And I think that's good. We want to be watching the show mm-hmm. and not marveling at the director's coolness.
Yeah.
There's nothing more annoying than constant cuts.
Yeah, right.
Like the Michael Bay school of directing, where, you know, when you try and watch Transformers and you just see close-ups of stuff and it's just lots of grey blurs and you go, what the hell is happening? So yeah, steady, slow cam work, when, especially when people are talking, makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Last week, Michael Chabon, whom we've talked about quite a bit on this show because he's the showrunner.
I've tweeted him a question, by the way.
Did you answer it?
No, I just tweeted him about 45 minutes before we saw the podcast.
Oh, have you?
There was a technical issue I have, and okay. I want to know if he can get back to me.
Have you checked your feed? Can you get back?
I have checked my feed. I have not gotten it.
All right.
I have not gotten a response.
Updates coming. But
yeah, but in the holodeck sequence, when he says, you know, freeze program,
yes.
The fire is still running in the background. And that bothered me the second viewing. I'm like, no, that should be frozen.
That's great. All right, so Chabon had an interview where he answered a few questions, and they were exactly the sort of thing that, as nerds, we were talking about last week. Why are the Vulcans wearing sunglasses? Why is Starfleet suddenly saying fuck? And why are people vaping in the 24th century? And the answer to these questions are, in reverse order, people are vaping because we believe in the show that objects will eventually attain a kind of perfect aesthetic shape. And once they hit that kind of perfect combination of function and form, they're just going to stay that way. Like, you're not going to keep reinventing the cigarette if the cigarette works fine. So in this case, the vaping pen is basically exactly what it needs to do with no frills. So why would it change? And so that's why the vaping pen still exists. The answer why suddenly all of Starfleet are swearing is not because they never swore before, but because CBS was censoring them. Right? Like, the show was a primetime television show on an American network, and you can't swear on television. And so, I mean, at one point, Chabon says, look, if you actually were not allowed to swear, that sounds like a dystopia to me. So that's why suddenly all the admirals are saying fuck. And then we get to the Vulcan with sunglasses, where someone says, hey, that was dumb. Vulcans have a second eyelid. And Chabon's like, yes, you're right, they do. Then what do you think we were saying with the sunglasses? So presumably this gives credence to the argument that she's not actually a Vulcan, that she's actually a Romulan.
Or mirror universe.
Or mirror. It
does, yeah,
not,
yeah,
it does,
yeah,
not disprove the mirror universe thing. But I think we all agree that we don't want that to happen.
That would just be too complicated.
Yeah. I'd rather have her be Romulan and just be like, okay, fine. You did it again, Romulans. You got another one in.
Yeah, you got another one.
Good job on you.
We will provide a link to this interview in our show notes, along with Jim dug up a link to the complete text of the book Rios is reading in not just one episode now, but two. He's reading the
He talks about this episode.
Yeah, he does. And it's called
The Tragic Sense of Life, I believe.
Sense of Life. And it's written by a Spanish author or Hispanic author?
Oh, it's Spanish.
Spanish.
It's written. Okay, so I did a little bit of reading into the book.
Yeah.
Before I hit the, I usually get about 20 to 30 pages into a philosophy book, and then I'm like, philosophy is entering a conversation, right? It's entering a centuries-old conversation. So if you don't know everything, like, when you go, you can't just pick up a book and be like, okay. Like, constantly you have to be referring back to footnotes, and in terms of, like, digital media, footnotes are the devil.
Yeah, okay. Like,
but in this book, it's released in the English translation is made in like 1917. No, 1919.
Okay.
It was right after the World War I.
Yep.
And you can tell it's very dated text because he keeps talking about, it's specifically a book meant for a male Christian audience.
Okay.
And he makes no beans about it. Like, he's a Spaniel. Spanish pride is dripping on these 20 pages.
Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's intentional that he's reading this book. Like, not only is it this thing about existential angst in terms of being aware of your death, of your endpoint, and that being tied to him losing his previous captain, yep, but the fact that it's so Spanish. It really is. Like, there's no other way for me to describe it. I have to say it's very Spanish.
So this Chabon also mentions this, because he mentions that someone asked, why is Rios smoking, when we've established that smoking is, as Aid noted last week, smoking is like just really weird and starved in the 24th century. Like, why would you be killing yourself with death sticks, right? But he does it because it's part of his Hispanic, his Latin heritage. And this is important to the character. And Chabon had him doing that to highlight his ethnicity and his cultural background. Which brings me back to Don Quixote. Because as we've noted from the very beginning, I have this secret obsession to discover that this show is actually heavily influenced by Don Quixote, which you know, arguably the greatest literary work in the Spanish language. And Picard is a perfect Don Quixote metaphor, because he is an old, idealistic man on a hopeless quest.
Who also may have mental issues.
Who has mental issues. Thank you. Yes.
And like, so that's the important thing. Like, that's the crux of that argument. Is not only is he an old idealist, but he's an old idealist who doesn't know if he's in control of his faculties.
Yes. And so, if you have a Don Quixote, you need a Sancho Panza. And Rios becomes Picard's Sancho Panza. If you know Don Quixote, Panza is the practical, no-nonsense guy who's not an idealist. He's a pragmatist. And he's the one that's always like, well, I guess we can do it your way if you insist, but it's a lot easier if we do it this way, you know? He's constantly overruled because he considers himself to be socially inferior to Quixote, because he acknowledges Quixote as the knight that Quixote thinks he is. And so even though Rios is no longer a Starfleet officer, and for that matter, neither is Picard, he nevertheless continues to treat Picard as if he was his superior officer. And we see that a couple of times quite brilliantly and funny in this episode, when they're both on the captain and trying to fulfill the captain's role kind of alternatively. The funny thing about all this, and the punchline about it for me, is that you can't name Rios's ship after Don Quixote's horse, because the Expanse already did that. The starship in the Expanse is called the Rocinante, which is Don Quixote's horse. And so we can't call Rios's ship that. Rios's ship is called something else. It's the
La Sona. It's the Siren in Spanish. The
Siren in Spanish. That name has got to have a literary pedigree.
Well, to get back to the literal Don Quixote touchstone in the book, like the concluding essay, when he's sort of wrapping up his thoughts, which I did read the conclusion, is Don Quixote in the contemporary European tragicomedy is the title.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I sent you the text. I sent you the picture of the text. That is the conclusion of the whole book. It's the Don Quixote reference. Well,
so that might be our show, gang. Aid, anything else that you wanted to bring in on this episode before we pass on?
Yeah, I'm just going to sit here while the academics discuss the finer things about Don Quixote. look like the moron in the room, so that's okay. So,
no, I did acknowledge that I dropped out in like 20 pages and just started skimming after that point.
So, my predictions for next episode, the 14-year flashback will be Seven of Nine meeting Picard. That's my prediction for that one. And the second prediction is, we will not see Riker or Deanna Troi except for one of those flashbacks. I do not think they will be current versions. I think they will be a flashback version. Yeah. I could be wrong, but I think being out there in space messing with Borg, they're not going to be sitting around waiting for them to show up. So I think it will be a flashback as well.
Jim suggested that we might meet them on Beta Z or something.
Yeah.
I see, my thinking is we're not going to get them in flashback. I think because, like, in the clips they've shown us, he's wearing the black jacket.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's wearing the black jacket.
It's like his beard. That's literally all I've seen. It's like, well, it could be anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now that they've established that he was wearing white right before the tragedy happens, and now he's wearing black, like, this episode very clearly establishes the color
pattern. Ah, gotcha.
He's in his cynical uniform when he meets Raiko. I think he's going to go to Raiko and Troy for, like, that emotional oomph to cross the finish line.
Okay, then I stick with my first prediction instead. 7 and 9 will be the flashback for next episode.
I hope so. I hope you're right, because, you know, that, you know, we very, very rarely see, like, characters interacting between the Bowman shows, right? Like, Raiko appeals constantly because Jonathan Frakes is directing. The Paul Bowman shows up in the Voyager episode, but we never see that initial meeting. Like, even in the Voyager episode that LeVar Burton shows up as Captain LaForge, it's already presumed that he's met Ensign Kim and Chakotay, and they already know him. So yep. The idea of having a forced meeting, I think, would be, like, that excites me.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our show for tonight, gang. Thank you, everyone, for watching. We will have a couple of links for you in the show notes. You can follow Jim at JimSeals1701 on Twitter.
Yep, I'm Brian.
And I am Dr. Comics. And that is Space Force.
See you next week.